I'm delighted to see so many people here because it's an area I think that is tremendously important, and it's an area that we often don't think about or don't talk about in families in terms of what do I want, what is needed in society, etc. And then what happens is somebody gets sick or somebody gets in crisis, and all the things that we haven't talked about have to be dealt with without any kind of preparation. And I'm just delighted and appreciative that we have this time to look at some of the ethical issues that are occurring in healthcare. The way I want to work this morning with us jointly is to look at some of the kinds of situations that come up in healthcare issues, to go through some definitions, some words that I find are very helpful, and you'll find people doing medical ethics are very helpful and empowering words. And then I want us to become ethics committees and to do the kinds of discussions that go on in committees now, often because it hasn't gone on in families and it hasn't gone on in churches and synagogues, so that each person will get a chance to do some participation in this very challenging, difficult area that is ending up more and more in the courts rather than in families, rather than in relationships between individuals and healthcare providers, rather than in the churches and synagogues, etc. As you know, my name is Phyllis Taylor, and I approach this out of a couple of interests. My own background is I have a first degree in sociology and am a community organizer, which is how Dick and I met, doing civil rights work. And that was very much my interest in justice. After we had children, I went to nursing school because it was a kind of situation where we never knew if what one's income or location would be like because we were civil rights workers. And when I finished nursing school, I looked around and thought, who gets the least care in our society? And the people who get the least care then, which is over 20 years ago, as well as now, at least in my experience, are people who are poor, people who are elderly, people who are minority. I have chosen to work in areas that address all three, and it really is that combination for me of my justice interest and my mercy interest. And somebody mentioned in Paul and Peter's Bible study that the passage they hear me talk about so often is that Micah passage from the prophet Micah, "What does the Lord require of thee but to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God?" And nowhere do I find this more played out than in the ethics area. My work in the hospital is multiple. I am an HIV coordinator for an urban hospital and medical school and satellite health centers, which means I spend a lot of time addressing the really frightening area of the AIDS virus. Who is at risk? How do we work with people who are infected? How do we help or accompany people who are dying of AIDS? I also spend equal amount of time working with people who have cancer. And there it is again, trying to accompany, to do pain and symptom management, to deal with the multiple pains, physical and spiritual and social and sexuality and financial. I have training also as what's called an enterostomal therapist, which means I work with folks who have colostomies and ileostomies and draining wounds and pressure ulcers or bed sores, et cetera, and I serve on an ethics committee. And the ethics committee is the pulling together of all those multiple interests. What are the kinds of situations that we're faced with? What are the kinds of situations that as a society I think we're faced with? And let me give you just a few types of cases, look at the definitions, and then we'll go back to the cases. A married, presumably monogamous man went to his physician, asked to be tested for HIV, turned out to be positive, and the physician called me and said, "What do I do now? Here is this man who is married, who is HIV infected, who is having unprotected intercourse because he had a vasectomy, so they don't have to use condoms, with his wife, who has not yet told his wife. What is my responsibility as a physician to him?" Because the physician-patient relationship, as the patient-counselor relationship, as the patient-clergy relationship, patient-social worker relationship. All of those relationships have been fairly sacred relationships in terms of confidentiality. What is my responsibility now, not just to my patient, the man who's HIV infected, but do I have any responsibility to his wife who is at risk and doesn't know she's at risk? Another case, also dealing with HIV because it raises multiple issues. A woman came to me. She is in a drug and alcohol rehabilitation program, is a recovering addict, is HIV infected again, was raped by a man in the center, and came to me because she had not gotten her period. What does she do? She's HIV infected. She knows inevitably within X number of years she will have AIDS and will die. The pregnancy was by rape. Does she abort? Does she carry the baby or fetus to term? What are the ethical issues? How do we work with her in making this terribly, terribly difficult decision? Another situation. I just want to lay a couple of these out for you because these are real situations. A woman came in with end-stage emphysema to our emergency room, was gasping for breath. Somebody said, "Do you want help in breathing?" She shook her head yes and ended up on a breathing machine. She had been very specific about never wanting to be on a breathing machine. What is the ethics involved in taking her off? Much easier to not put somebody on the technologies than to take them off the technologies. It is true with respirators or breathing machines. It is true with dialysis. What do we do in those situations? What did we do in that situation? What will you all do as the ethics committee in a little bit in that situation? Another one, very challenging. We had a woman who was in her early 50s, retarded, had been cared for by her mother, who had, in the time of caring for her, become a widow, had had a heart attack. The mother had a pacemaker now to help her heart beat. Mother was in her 70s and no longer could physically care for this daughter who was in her 50s chronologically, but who was maybe two emotionally. The woman was put in a respite center, a place to give her mom some rest to make decisions, and she stopped eating. She was brought into the hospital for complications from stopping eating, and the choice we had to make is, do we forcibly feed her? She was like Houdini. I have never seen anybody get out of restraints. We would put tubes in her nose, down her stomach to feed her. She pulled it out. We put her arms in restraints. We tied her down. Somehow she got out of those. And the question we were left with is, do we put in a feeding tube and keep this woman in restraints? Or do we let her stop eating and basically starve to death in somebody who does not have the, because of her retardation, the intellectual ability to make those decisions? We had to make the decision. Again, what would you do? Last one I want to give you just as a broad decision was one that deals with infants. With the technology we have, we now, with a 15-ounce baby or 1.5-pound baby or a baby that's got profound problems, have the ability to keep these infants alive. We had a child born or transferred to us who was born with a rare disease called osteogenesis imperfecta. The bones were imperfect. We have 212 bones in our body. Probably going through the birth canal, this child broke about 150 of them. Her entire ribs were separated from her sternum or breastbone, which meant she couldn't breathe on her own. If she went to the bathroom, she couldn't cry because she had the tube in, because she was attached to the respirator, but we watched her face, and she kept grimacing every time she had a bowel movement because her pelvis was crushed. How long do we keep this baby alive? At how much cost? Emotionally? And at how much cost financially? Those are the hard questions that we need to deal with. Now, let me give you some ethical definitions that I think are really important for us. One of the words that's very difficult is ethics. If you look at Webster's dictionary, ethics is described as the discipline dealing with what is good and bad, and with duty and obligation, a theory or system of moral values. We live in a very pluralistic society. What is good and what is bad? What is ethical? Probably nowhere do we see this more debated now than in the area of abortion. There are one set of goods is an opposite to another set of goods. And it's not at all surprising to me that we have the kind of intense conflict that we have around the abortion issue based on this definition of ethics when the definition we're given is what is good and bad. Who decides what is good and bad? Well, what are some important definitions? Advance directive, very, very important. It says in advance, I direct my doctor, my family, my clergy, and what I want. And that's based on this principle of autonomy, a person having control or right over his or her own body. The principle of autonomy involves abortion as well. Do I have a right to control my own body? But what happens when in my body is another body? We're wrestling this through very strongly at the hospital now because so many people who get stuck by needles are nurses. And because nurses are mostly women still. And one of the things that's talked about now in HIV is that we know that if we give a medicine called AZT early on, when people have the virus, we can postpone the day they develop AIDS. And the question that's being looked at is if a healthcare worker, say if I get stuck by a needle of somebody who's HIV positive, and I have his or her blood in me, therefore I am at risk of the virus, should I take AZT? Now, well, we don't know if it works or not. But one of the questions as we're writing up this policy right now is, should women who are stuck with known HIV positive needles or somebody who's at high risk be denied AZT because I might be pregnant or I am pregnant? You're pitting my body, which and the AZT, if it works, could help save my life, but damage the fetus or baby I might be carrying. So right now we're wrestling through that whole question in our hospital in terms of policies, and I know a number of hospitals are on this question of autonomy. Taking it back to not the complicated area of abortion and two bodies in one, basically, or two living beings in one, but back to advanced directives. The way people translate advanced directives out are either having a living will, 38 states have a living will, and this basically says, and I have copies of this if people want to see them, it basically says in advance, I will tell you what I want if X, Y, and Z happens to me. I think living wills are tremendously important to have so that I can stay in control of what I want. It also frees Dick up, for example, of not having to make those terrible decisions because I have told him in advance, as well as my doctor, lawyer, clergy, what I want. But we're finding even more than living wills, something called durable power of attorney is vitally, vitally important because what this says is that I appoint somebody to make not only financial decisions for me, which is what power of attorney is, but I appoint somebody to make medical decisions for me. And I'm finding this very important now as families have broken up. Who knows me best? Is it a cousin of mine, but not my ex-husband or separated husband? Is it a friend of mine, much more than my family? I mean, who knows? Who can make these decisions for me? This says, who can make it for me if I can't make for myself? Another area that is a tremendously complicated ethical area that has come up particularly now with HIV infection is confidentiality. Do I have the right or obligation ethically to violate confidentiality and tell somebody, like that man's wife, that her husband is HIV infected, which tells her, in effect, that he has not been faithful to her. That's the hardest, that one of the questions that they're wrestling with is, do I now potentially destroy a marriage by violating confidentiality on a health basis? So the confidentiality area is a big one that is being very hotly debated, as it never has been before, because of HIV. Beneficence, also a very important ethical concept. The benefit-burden ratio is something like the feeding tube in that retarded woman. Is that going to be beneficial for her, or is it really going to be more burdensome? Yeah. Beneficial, it'll save her life. Burdensome, if she's in all restraints for the rest of her life, what is the quality of that life? Burden-benefit ratio, very important one, comes up with antibiotics, it comes up with ventilators or respirators or breathing machines, comes up very often now. What about surrogate? That means the person who can make decisions for me if I can't make them for myself. The surrogate is the person who is named as durable power of attorney. But there is a whole group of people we're finding now who don't have surrogates. Many of them, the what we call the unbefriended incompetent, or the legal people call it unbefriended incompetent. We call it the unbefriended decisionally incapable, because incompetence is a legal word. Many of them are people who have entered nursing homes, families no longer come, or they've lost contact with families. They're admitted into hospitals from the nursing home, and there is not a single person who is there to make decisions. Then you go to court to get somebody appointed, but that is very expensive, and it's time-consuming, and hospitals don't want to have to pay $3,000 or $4,000 to get somebody appointed. And so oftentimes that's not done, and we end up doing terrible things to people because no surrogate was ever named. One of the things that we are working on, and a number of hospitals are working on, is to have ethics committees named as surrogate decision makers. That puts even more sense of awesomeness on us. Should it be a clergy person, a member of the church, who becomes the surrogate? What about euthanasia? Does somebody have the ethical right, obligation, I'm taking it out of the law, but into ethics, to help somebody die who wants to die? Hotly debated, because there are a lot of times, in previous years, this was done quietly, often between the physician and the person who is ill. But there is such a concern about the law now and being sued that it still goes on, but it's being talked about more. Another that we just read about was assisted suicide. The physician who created the machine that the woman from Washington State, was it, who had a beginning of Alzheimer's, knew what she might be like in a number of years, knew that at some point she would lose the ability to make decisions for herself, and chose to end her life, but for the people who have asked me, and I have had people ask me to kill them, for the people who have asked me to do that, one of the biggest concerns is they will botch it. And they will end up, in a permanent coma, and the very reasons why they wanted to end their life, which is often to save their family, financial destruction and emotional destruction, will have occurred. And so will people who know help and assist. This doctor set up the machine that enabled the woman basically to end her own life, but it was with an assist, because without the technology and without him mixing the ingredients and without him putting the line in her veins, she could not have done it and known it would work. So assisted suicide is an area that's a big one, and it's not just physicians. There's a young man in California who has lost between 60 and 70 friends to AIDS. And he has been helping people who know what the end of AIDS is like and who don't want to go through that final indignity. He has been sitting with them, mixing pills, giving them the cocktail. They're the ones who drink it, but he has been there. Is he a murderer? Is he a lover? Not in a sexual way,
with somebody who loves. So assisted suicide, also. Very important area that's being talked about, needs to be talked about because it's happening. What are the areas we're seeing this in? And then I want to make us committees. Okay? Obviously, the area of abortion is an area that's hotly debated in terms of ethics. What is right, what is wrong, in terms of the fetus versus the woman in some situations? What happens if it's an inconvenient pregnancy? Is that different than somebody who's carrying a child that might be HIV infected versus somebody who is, say, where the parents both have Tay-Sachs disease, which is a genetic disease for which the children always die? There is no child with Tay-Sachs who has ever lived. And the death is a hard death, you know, somewhere between before the age usually of 4. So if you know you're carrying a child that is absolutely going to die, what about that? Are there differences in gradations? So abortion is a big area. Another one that is already happening but not much talked about is the rationing of healthcare. Who will get some of the technologies that we have? Are poor people going to be denied them? The reality is, at least in inner cities, poor people already are being denied. Wealthier people are admitted into the hospital, and one of the things that happens is people look a lot at insurance. And it's the questions of who's got good insurance that often determines what kind of care and the intensity of care people get. So this is already happening, and I think, and many people think, it will get much worse. The whole area of critical care, the intensive care unit, NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. How much do we spend financially on somebody? If you have a baby that is born very prematurely, how much do you spend on that child, knowing that the probability — there are miracles, but I don't see them very often — the probability that child will die and that child's care before they die will be $500,000. And I've seen that. I've seen that happen. We had one child, and this was over 10 years ago, when the child finally died, the parents were given a bill of $250,000. That's 10 years ago. Probably they would have gotten a bill for $1,000,000. We knew that child was going to die. And we resuscitated the baby over and over again. We parented the baby. Baby cut her first tooth on an oxygen hood. And the baby died at 10 months, and the family's left with $250,000. Should we have done that? Should we have said the baby is too small, the baby has too bad a heart defect, and let the baby die early on? Should we have done that with that baby with the osteogenesis imperfecta? We knew the baby couldn't survive off the respirator, so why did we keep the baby on the respirator? When do you say no? And the same is true often in the intensive care units and the coronary care units as well. What about DNR? It means do not resuscitate. One of the things that is being looked at strongly, and it's in conflict with autonomy, is we know that somebody with statistically we know, somebody with metastatic cancer, cancer that's spread, whose heart stops or whose breathing stops, and we start it up again, have a zero chance of leaving the hospital. We might start them up again till they code again, and we might resuscitate them again until they code again, and then we don't. It's zero success. If it's zero success, why do we do it? It's tremendously costly emotionally and financially. So should we be doing that? There are a couple of hospitals like Massachusetts General who is now overriding people's wishes. I might say with metastatic cancer, I want everything done. My right with autonomy. And Mass General, some people at Mass General are saying, no, we won't do it, even if you want it, even if it's your life. Is that what we want? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And some of that gets back to autonomy, and it gets back to rationing of healthcare, etc. Transplants. How much do we spend on heart transplants and liver transplants and many of the other transplants? We can harvest. That's what it's called, harvesting organs. But at what cost? And if we have X amount of money, do we spend that money on prenatal care, or do we spend it on transplanting hearts?
very difficult. One of the nurses' husbands had a heart transplant, a successful one with a first heart, and he came and he talked to us about the wonderful miracle of the transplants. And in the face of that young man who was vital and healthy and full of life, do we say sorry? You never should have had it in the first place, because we've got a NICU, a neonatal intensive care unit, too full of babies born too prematurely because there wasn't enough good care, particularly for poor parents, poor mothers, and we've just allocated the money to you and not to them, and then what are we left with? Transplants will get bigger and bigger as we have more and more technology to do heart and lung transplants, etc. Is that what we want as a society and as religious people? What about dialysis? In England, people who are 65 do not have the option for dialysis. That ageism? How do we make that decision? What happened? I'm old enough to remember when we had committees that made that decision, when we didn't have a lot of dialysis machines, and it was so uncomfortable that inevitably the government stepped in and said, we'll let anybody who needs dialysis be dialyzed and we'll pick up the cost. But the cost is tremendous now, absolutely tremendous. And dialysis is one that is going to be looked at again, many people think, because it is such a costly procedure in the long run. And why? Yeah. At some point, people can't get kidney transplants, so do we continue them on dialysis for the rest of their life? Is there a time that there's a cutoff, and what criteria makes the cutoff? Should it be age? Should it be that the homeless person versus the bank president, both of them needing a kidney, both of them needing a dialysis machine? Who gets it? Whose life is more valuable? The two that are the most emotionally difficult, I think, are feeding and hydration. It's what made the retarded woman's situation so difficult. Do we not feed when the only way to feed is a tube? And then what about hydration or fluids? When do we stop that? Should we ever stop that? We are a society that loves to feed. We are nurtured here by the superb food at Holden. Families feed all the time as a way of showing love. Is it ever right to stop? I want to kind of end with that and see if you have any questions or thoughts, and then make you into committees and have you wrestle through some of those. Any questions right off before you get into small groups and go through how you would, what you would come up with?
You mentioned that living wills are available and are legal in many states. Are there some states that absolutely refuse them, say you cannot have a living will?
Yeah, there's still 12 states that don't, including Pennsylvania, where I live, that don't honor them. But there are many variations of living wills, and many times some states that say they have to be reissued, re-witnessed, etc. And many people, Dick and I both have a living will and durable power of attorney, even though living will isn't legal in Pennsylvania.
Let's say that Pennsylvania would not allow it to be carried out for you?
By law, not. But when we have somebody who has a living will, it often frees us up as health people to say, well, we're following their wishes, and so we'll follow it through.
It's not that it's legally prohibited from having a living will, but it's not legally recognized as binding, isn't that right? I mean, Pennsylvania doesn't say you may not have a living will.
It's a worthless piece of paper. You know, I could say I'm president of the United States. It's worthless. I'm not. The living will in Pennsylvania is legally worthless.
Even if you write it and sign it yourself?
Correct. Correct. Uh-huh.
Can you take it to another state and use it in another state?
If I died in the other state, or if I got into a car accident in the other state, no. But it's illegal. I'm a resident of Pennsylvania, so I would not be at all sure that if I were injured in Ohio, that the physician in Ohio would honor my living will in Pennsylvania. I don't think they would, even though Ohio might have a living will, which is why durable power is so important, and why nurses say we're going to tattoo on our chest DNR. So if somebody rips our clothes off, I mean, we're not going to bother with medical alert bracelets or anything else. That might get lost. I mean, that's how strongly most nurses who see what codes are like and who know if I were that injured or that permanently damaged, I don't want that done. We want a tattoo. The closest thing I have a tattoo at this point is Dick. because I made him durable power. And if God forbid we were both in the accident, we have, I mean, that living will is with our lawyer, with a lot of other people, so that they would, or the durable power, they would follow through on it. Yeah. Let me do a few more questions, and then I really do want to get into the experience.
You mentioned the difficulty of removing the apparatus if you put it on. What ramifications in law developed that caused this difficulty?
In taking somebody off?
Yes. What do you have to go through on?
Varies from state to state. And let me, with a woman, if you can hold that one, maybe the first case we'll do is the woman who ended up on the respirator who had end-stage emphysema. Should we take her off or not? She had a living will in Pennsylvania. She also had durable power. And that gave us some insight into what we could or could not do. So if you can hold that, we'll go back. Because again, it does vary from hospital to hospital.
In Pennsylvania, do they have durable power of attorney?
Yes. All states have durable power. Not all states have living wills.
And you recommend that they have both?
I recommend both because the durable power says this is the person who can make the decisions for me. The living will very clearly spells out what decisions. I have copies of durable power and living will here. The durable power says who can do it. The living will says these are the things I don't want done to me. And so it can address respirators, feeding tubes, antibiotics, blood transfusions, et cetera. It's more specific.
Do all attorneys have copies of this durable power of attorney thing that you have there?
Not all, but one of the copies I use most was actually in the AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons had one that was a very simple one. I've sometimes said if you can't afford going to a lawyer, just say, I appoint, Richard K. Taylor as my decision maker. I appoint him with durable power of attorney, and I've had it witnessed and authorized. That's fine. Back there, and then we'll go into committee.
I have a lot of questions, but this one I suspect might come up in our committee. So I'm wondering, what is the death like of somebody who is denied IV feeding or fluids?
Mm-hmm. It is not bad, because I watch and I talk. I have been royally challenged and called a murderer when I was trying to help somebody who kept saying, please take me home, take me home. Now we've got the technology to give people fluids at home and feedings at home, but at that point we didn't have to. We didn't. And the doctor came, I was so clear, the doctor came up to me and said, how could you encourage that? Have you ever been on an island in the middle of the ocean without water? And I said, no, I haven't. He said, have you ever had your tongue swell and get black, and thirst? I said, no, I haven't. And he said, then how can you encourage this person to go home? And he, not only did he do that to me, he did that to the family. And they backed off. And a week later, they said, all she wants, she keeps pleading, take me home, please take me home. We're going to take her home. And they did, and she died in about a week. And they came back to me and said, it wasn't like he said at all. Yep. What I find, actually, in my experience, is that as people get dehydrated, they, in many ways, have less problems with respiratory, with breathing problems. With food, there is a period when there is discomfort, but it is a gradual kind of thing. When people in concentration camps or prisoners of war or poor people who can't get meals are hungry, and there is that growling of the stomach and the discomfort. When somebody is not eating because they are dying, the reports we get is the looking at people, and I ask people all the time, how are you feeling? What is happening? If they can talk to me. It is not the same. Starvation is a very loaded word, and people, prisoners of war, starve, and that has a connotation that is very powerful. People who are dying who don't eat don't have that same experience, so it seems. So it is not particularly a painful experience in the ways we know it as people who are healthy now and who get hungry. Yes, sir?
I'm troubled by the question of right and wrong in terms of Holocaust experience, and I'd like your response from the Jewish tradition about this. I am a parent of a profoundly retarded child, And I'm aware that Adolf Hitler and the Nazi movement did not just exterminate Jews, but exterminated the enlisted people, and just exterminated mentally retarded and physically handicapped people. I think one of the reasons I can't go along with all the technology thing is because I'm subconsciously always aware of the Holocaust and aware of what we might do as human beings to one another because we've done it before.
I think that we have to be extraordinarily careful and not take one person's definition of quality of life and say that my definition is the right one. This person is profoundly retarded, can't enjoy life, and therefore, you know, should be eliminated or euthanized or whatever term one wants. I don't believe in that at all. But we'll do, and I appreciate your sharing that about your family, we will do one. We'll do one, the first case, perhaps the one of the woman on the respirator who had the living will, who said she never wanted to be on the respirator. And the second one will be the retarded adult and the question of feedings. And should we forcibly feed in that case? And then, you know, see where we come out as committees in terms of what is right or wrong in those situations. If there aren't other questions, just so we have the time and the experience, why don't you pull together in groups of about four or five as quickly as you can? Okay, here's the first case. Woman came in with end-stage emphysema or end-stage pulmonary disease. Emphysema, end-stage. She was the end of her illness. Her lungs were no longer able to really function. And so she was short of breath much of the time, pretty well bedbound much of the time. It was a real effort just to breathe. She got in real trouble, was brought into the emergency room, was asked, you know, while she's going, which is how it might be, do you want help breathing? She didn't realize, apparently at that point, that the only way she could be helped was to be put on a breathing machine, to have a tube put down her throat, into her trachea or breathing pipe, which meant she could no longer talk, and attached to a machine. That was done. After it was done, her niece, who had durable power of attorney, said, my aunt has a living will, and it says there, no respirator. Are you gonna follow her wishes? Will you take her off, knowing that if you take her off, she will die?
Is she alert?
At that point, she was not alert, and we didn't know if she would become alert in time for us to hear from her own mouth what she wanted, but clearly she had written it down.
What would happen to her if she remained on the respirator?
She would be on the respirator for months, years potentially. We would do, you can't keep a person on a respirator with a tube in their nose or mouth for a long period of time. You have to, after, you know, 7 days, 10 days, do a trach, make a hole in the throat and put the breathing tube in through the throat.
But this question about alertness, could she become alert again?
Yes, she could.
And could she eat?
No, she could not with a respirator.
With the trach
attached to the machine, people have trachs and they eat fine because the breathing tube of the trachea is separate from the esophagus or the feeding tube. But with a trach, on the respirator, on the breathing machine, I have never seen anybody eat this way. Okay. We feed them other ways. We put tubes in their stomachs.
For now, dispensing with what the law says, we're discussing what the law should be.
The law has not told us in some states what you can and cannot do.
Okay, but in some states it has told us. So for purposes of this discussion, are we just setting the law aside and seeing what law would come up?
And what is the ethics in it? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is there any chance that she would come off the respirator, or no chance at all?
The chance is minute. that because of her underlying condition, which is not going to get better, her lungs are shot, the chance of her coming off the respirator is minute.
What happens when they take her off? Would she breathe for a while?
We don't know. We don't know if we keep her on, she was going to become alert and be able to write to us. We don't know if we take her off, would she die right away, or would she live for a while? We don't know if she's going to struggle if we take her off and breathe. We didn't know any of that. You don't know any of that, but you are faced with this woman on a respirator who has said very clearly beforehand to her niece and written it out, I do not want to be on a respirator.
How much time span was there, or how current was the living will? How many years? Or?
Within a few years.
Did she come from a nursing home?
Yeah, she came from home. Why don't you go into committee, and I will give you 2 or 3 minutes, not long.
And your committee? Honor advance.
Right? To honor the advance directive. Mm-hmm. Yours also?
Yeah, 4-1.
Okay, back there?
We're the same.
How about yours?
We didn't do that. We felt that she came in and she, having had that disease, she would have some clue as to what helping breathing would mean. We felt like for a while we would need to have her, hopefully, we need more information. We need to talk to her physician. We need to talk more to this niece, to other people that have been around her, because if this living will was several years old, her attitude could have changed. Mm-hmm. And we felt like maybe this was her first time of critical attack being brought in from home. Mm-hmm. If she'd been in the hospital for a long time already, we would have felt differently about it. But we felt at that point in time we couldn't do that.
Many of the things you raise are things that other people raise. I think they're very, and they're important questions.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And yours? Committee, what did you decide?
I think we went with the niece having durable power. If the niece was willing to make the statement that she wanted to be off, that we'd go along with that. Okay.
What we did decide was to honor the wishes. And to the real discomfort of our corporate attorneys and the risk manager, we do take people off ventilators. What we did in this case, it was very interesting, and I'm very thankful that she had both a living will and durable power, because after she was critically ill, suddenly a daughter appeared who had not seen her mother in 4 years. And the daughter said, but I'm the daughter. This is my cousin. I should make the decision. I want absolutely everything done. And we find that oftentimes it's the errant family out of guilt that says do everything. And we were able to say, no, we're sorry, we will not listen. Ultimately, we will not listen to you. We will listen to the niece.
So, can they sue? Yeah. I mean, can they?
No, because durable power has a legal basis.
It has a legal basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If that person had been, because she'd been on the ventilator, became alert and coherent, then would you have asked her?
Yes, we would have asked her, and in fact, that did happen. It did happen with this woman, and it happened one other time. And the physician went in, and he said, "Do you still want us to take you off?" And the woman shook her head. And then I went in about a half an hour later and went through the same conversation. "Do you still want us to take you off? Do you understand that if we take you off, you will probably die?" And it was incredibly moving. Shook their head yes. And what we did was, with the daughter present, as well as the niece, as well as the doctors, and any doctor that wanted to be, the attending had to be there, and the nurses, and if there had been clergy, it would have been wonderful to have clergy. What we did was to put on an oxygen mask, had it available. So as soon as we took the tube out, we wanted to give her every option for life. And this is the procedure we usually do. We put the mask on. We also gave some morphine. Sometimes we'll give morphine, sometimes Valium, because one of the most difficult things is to be alert and gasping. As one doctor said, it is like a beached whale, and it is just hard. So we give some loading dose to take the edge off, not enough in any way to kill the person, but to ease any suffering that might be for that person. We explain everything, took the tube out. I've had invited families, if they wanted to do the extubation, the taking out of tube, whatever the family wants, I will do. And then once that has happened, oftentimes I'll encourage the family, but if they can't, I'll talk to the person. We are here. You are loved. It is your daughter holding this hand. It is your niece holding your others. There are doctors and nurses here. You're surrounded by, most of the people I work with are Christian. You're surrounded by Jesus. And I will talk them through the dying with usually tears.
Did she die?
No. Not right away. And it raised the second question. I've had people die within 27 minutes, you know, or something like that. And I've had people live for days. What happened was that she didn't die right away. And then the question of putting a feeding tube in came up. She could not eat. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of breathing power to eat. And because she had the living will that said no feeding tubes, we did not feed her. And she died after about 4 days. Surrounded by family, surrounded by friends, and she was still in charge. So it was surrounded by a dignity.
So she was alert then at this point?
She became alert. We took her off the machine. She stayed alert for a while and then slipped into an unconsciousness.
Were there IV fluids going on, or just?
In her case, we maintained IV mostly for the family. It was just sugar water. Okay. But I have also been in situations where we have not had even IVs running, because to have IVs running would have meant restraints. Let's move into the second situation. And it is the one of the profoundly retarded woman, and I appreciate you raising it, who stopped eating. Who stopped eating. And, you know, her family came in and they tried to feed her. We thought, well, you know, we're strange. Maybe she's scared. We don't know what's going on inside her. We worked out, you know, family, any, you know, 24-hour visiting, maybe they could get her to eat. We didn't know, is she angry and has she stopped eating in anger? Or was something else going on? She was nonverbal. She grunted. And so we couldn't tell what was going on. This is the retarded woman. Yeah, she was in her 50s. Her mother was in her 70s, but was now elderly and frail. She had just been placed in a home for profoundly retarded individuals. And the question that came to us, that now comes to you, is if the only way to feed her is to do it forcibly, we had tried all other ways, do we forcibly feed her, which also meant restrain her arms and restrain her chest?
What did her mother say?
Mother couldn't cope with it. The mother just could not make the decision.
No living will, no.
Oh, no, no, because she was not able to communicate what she really wanted.
So and the hospital had to make that decision.
It was brought to us. And oftentimes in the ethics committees, in almost all ethics committees I know of, the ethics committee cannot say, you will do this and you will follow what we say. Uh-huh. It is, we will give you ethical backing and we will help you think through the issues and we will give you questions to ask and we will make recommendations. Our ethics committee is made up of four physicians, a geriatrician, somebody who specializes in the elderly, a neonatologist, somebody who specializes in the newborn, a surgeon, and a family practitioner. There are two nurses, and there is an ethicist, a Methodist minister, who did his doctorate in ethics. So that makes up the committee.
And she's mentally 2 years old?
She's around 2 years old and could not help us at all in terms of what she wanted. All we knew is that she clamped her teeth anytime we tried to feed her, and anytime we put a tube in her nose, she pulled it out. Anytime we put an IV in her arm, she pulled it out. And as I said, she was like Houdini. I have never seen anybody get out of restraints the way this woman was able to.
Did she have other medical problems?
No.
No,
she
just wouldn't eat.
She just wouldn't eat, and we didn't know why. They tried working her up to figure out, was there something going on? Nothing showed up. And so we were left with that stark decision. What do we do? One other question?
She stopped eating just when she entered the institution.
That is correct. Okay.
Is there no possibility of taking her out of the institution? There was nowhere else she could?
It looked like the only place she would want to go was back to her mother's. But her mother was elderly.
No other family.
There were family that came in, but nobody, I mean, we had the mother come in to try and feed her. But the home that she knew was her mother's home, and her mother got to that point with tremendous pain, tremendous pain. And this was not the first time this has happened to us with somebody who was retarded, and the parents could no longer physically manage.
Basically, what you're saying to us is the home is no longer an option.
The home is no longer an option. Some kind of basically boarding home, nursing home is the only option. This woman will not eat except if we restrain her and forcibly feed her. Should we, committee, do that? Should we put a tube in her and tie her down?